Hello, and welcome back to Literally Literary. If this is your first time joining us, be sure to check out our previous episodes. This episode, we will be continuing our discussion on Funeral for Flaca by Emily Prado, where we'll be discussing the first half of the collection of essays.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Richie.
What's up? How's it going?
It's going.
How's the chair feel? How's it feel sitting in the seat?
The hot seat.
The captain's chair.
It feels nice and cozy, warm, welcoming. For now.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad you're back after our previous episode where we said goodbye. Jorge, so dramatic, right?
So dramatic. I know you're listening, Jorge, and I just want to say that we didn't vote you out. I mean, it's, and rightfully so. I mean, he was saying goodbye to 2 years of doing podcast and hanging out with you all on Sundays. It's a big thing. Yeah, big deal.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. But he has lots on his plate. Working on all these different other projects, so we wish him the best. Yeah. And I'm sure he'll be back soon.
Here.
Yes.
So this episode will be our first episode where we dive into Funeral for Flaca by Emily Prado. And so last time we talked a little bit about overall impressions, themes, topics. We talked a little bit about also the poetry reading with Emily and Gris that happened at Casa Ortiz. And so today we'll be focusing on, roughly the first half, and whatever we don't get to, we'll discuss in our next episode, our concluding episode, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So I think we'll start with just the layout of the book. And I know we talked a little bit about this last time, but I really enjoyed that it's broken up into tracks. So it starts with an intro, ends with the outro, and has 17 tracks. And Vanessa, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the playlist that Emily has, her alias DJ Mami Miami. So we can start with the intro, if you all want.
Yeah. I think this one's really important.
Yes.
I think we talk about this a lot. Just the idea of community. She kind of focuses a lot here. And the people that have just supported her work, throughout.
Yeah, so this one is, it's the intro, so it still serves its purpose on the playlist, but also in any book, right? So it's the impetus for genesis of the book, how it evolved over the years. And she did talk a little bit about this at her reading as well. And Richie mentioned how it was a zine at first and kind of evolved and into what it is now. And here she also sets us up for the topics that we'll be seeing, that we've talked about, like identity, love, trauma, grief. And she ends it with the words, "Trace my metamorphosis. I hope this collection offers you nectar." Mm-hmm. Really nice kind of way to lead us into the essays and her life story.
Yeah, I think this one also talks a little bit about, finding your voice, which I think we talked a lot about, especially with the Poetex. And I even wrote, because a lot of these quotes come from diary entries, which was the same thing with the Poetex. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I know we talked about that with Connections last episode. With the intro, I like how she lays out the foundation to expand what you're going on, Vanessa. Also kind of talking about the difference between her writing voice versus her, speaking voice. Mm-hmm. That she found it a lot easier to express on page. And I definitely experienced that growing up. Like, to me, it was just easier to express my thoughts writing something down on page. Or, like, at the age I was, like, instant messenger or whatever. Mm-hmm. AIM. I don't know if you guys remember. Did you ever use that? Remember? Mm-hmm. The screen name and all that. And ooh, this is all pre social media, MySpace and all that. you know, I like how she acknowledges the relationship that also, in addition to writing, is music plays in her. She describes it as her radicalization and intro. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to explore that a bit in her chapters. And I believe we talked about audience too last time. So hopefully you guys did have a chance to check out that playlist, tinyurl.com/flaca-playlist. I think my dashes and slashes right.
I think so. If not, just switch them.
Backslash. Place them. It's backslash, right?
Yes.
Forward slash. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't ask me. I don't know what I'm doing.
Okay. Anyway.
I do like, just as like a final thought, unless you all have anything else to say about the intro. I do like that she starts it by saying, I didn't grow up believing I could be a writer, which is already, that's the first sentence, and it's already so relatable. Like, how many of us are something now that we never thought we could be, or just, you know, kind of like that imposter syndrome that creeps up all the time. Mm.
Yeah.
But I really like that she started that way, because you're like, wait a minute, but you wrote this book that I'm holding in my hands, you know? It was kind of nice, and seeing how that eventuated too.
I love that contrast of reading the line and then know that you're physically holding the book.
Yeah.
Or maybe reading on a tablet or whatever, but you're seeing the product there. Maybe to expand on that, I think also it's important. I think it is important how she differentiates too on how she's going to write. She's not going to write like Shakespeare. And, you know, when I teach writing, any kind of writing course, really, you know, a lot of students, or we tend to get it in our heads that we have to write a certain way, right? Proper, quote unquote, proper. But, you know, most of us know that language is always changing and evolving in cultures. And so she kind of acknowledges too that she's going to be using her own, like she, her own voice and her own words, right? She mentions that using slang and shorthand, and we recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just recognizing that as well as you're reading it, like, oh yeah, okay, this it's more relatable. It makes it more relatable, right? Because a lot of, you know, when I tell my students, like, yo, Shakespeare, like, that's a lot of antiquated stuff too, you know, even though it's English, you have to often translate it. So I just like how she again making it her own, finding her own voice. It's a pretty strong intro.
And I think, well, she also talks about Tupac in the intro and lets us know why she uses the playlist or establishes mood with the track titles. Just kind of letting the reader know this is why I made these choices and what inspired me. And so if that doesn't bring you in, I don't know what will.
Which is such a fun creative thing. You know, I think we talked about it the first episode, but I enjoy making playlists, you know, based on moods and themes and kind of having an inner narrative to the way they're ordered, you know, like a narrative movement of some sort, and the songs telling their own stories. And I know, I think we all mentioned doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun to see this in this book, right? In tracks.
Yeah.
Have a certain flow to it.
And in the book, you know, they're meant to be read or quote unquote listened to in order chronologically, right? So same as with playlists. I know a lot of us like to have that shuffle option on. Vanessa, looking at you. No, I'm just kidding.
Called out.
Not playlists.
No, I know. I love the shuffle option, but when it's a playlist, and if someone takes the time to create a playlist, they know what they're doing. They know why they put this song before that song.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we need to honor that.
There's emotional context. You can't listen to this song until you've experienced this one.
Right.
Because you've had to go through that journey first.
Exactly.
And you can appreciate it a little differently now. Perfect.
Exactly. It is a journey. Yeah. And I think it's expressed really well in this book.
I missed it when she came into town, but has she recorded this in audiobook form?
I don't know. That's a good question.
When you talked about listening to playlists, you know, and the way that these each essay here is labeled as a track, that would, I mean, the natural thing would be like an audiobook too, like track one, track two. But I guess we can ask her about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully we can get her on.
Emily, please.
Say you'll be there, which just happens to be track number one.
Oh, hey. Great transition. Natural.
So track one. Yeah, so the book is structured chronologically. So in chapter one, Say You'll Be There, she's in kindergarten. And I really love this chapter a lot because you see the innocence, the vulnerability of this kid who's like navigating language and, you know, best friends and she calls it namesake. What's the word for
she like was named after?
Yes, she talks about that on 21, but yeah. So it's just a lot of stuff that when you're a kid, you're noticing these things and then you don't quite understand them fully until later. And she's dealing with a lot of stuff, you know, that potentially could be and ends up being traumatic, right? But but she's kind of just going through it as a 5 or 6 year old.
Yeah.
I really like on page 20, the code switching. And I identified a lot with, with this. There's going to be a lot of moments. I think I mentioned this in the first episode, but there's going to be a lot of moments where I'm going to say, and then in my family, this happened too, because like a lot of it is, is my experience. So in that paragraph before the break, it says, cuando empecé kinder, I mostly only spoke español. I'd ask my mommy, ¿cuál estoy hablando ahora? What about now? And I suppose I did this until my tongue learned which way to dance for different people. Kindergarten was the first time I was in school for a whole year. My two stints in preschool were cut short. My mommy said I became fluent in English in 3 months. No recuerdo when my thoughts, mi lengua, followed suit. I don't remember when I stopped dreaming in Spanish.
Wow.
I love, loved that paragraph. Just because of, you know, there's that switching and her not understanding like the differences between languages. And I remember I spoke only Spanish until I went to kinder as well. And my mom, you know, only speaks Spanish. And so I, she says it like one day I just came home and just started speaking English to her. And I was talking to her like at her in English and she's like, ¿qué estás diciendo? Like, she got upset with me. She's like, no me estás hablando así. And I was like, wait, what am I doing wrong? Like, I didn't understand what was happening. But then I realized, oh, she doesn't understand me when I use this. So only Spanish at home. So it was really cool to kind of read this and remember that specific memory.
Yeah, I underlined that too. What, did you have anything, any memories on that?
On that paragraph? I mean, I also started with just speaking Spanish.
Yeah.
And then now I don't really speak a whole lot of Spanish. So I mean, I understand it enough. But I know that, like, I mean, my experience with Spanish is, I guess, really different because, I mean, in school, most people that I was in classes with only spoke English or, like, they were fluent in both. And if they heard me speaking in Spanish, they would make fun of my more American accent, I guess, in speaking Spanish. And so I kind of just stopped.
Yeah, it's kind of my experience too. I grew up like before school, you know, for my grandparents, they only spoke Spanish. So that's what I started first kind of speaking too. And then going to school and socializing and making friends, everyone spoke English. So that ended up like yeah, my Spanish is terrible now. And because mm-hmm. I just kind of stopped at a certain point, like, just, you know, I lost that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I love how she acknowledges that there's a transition and mm-hmm. you know, she ends with that. When did I stop dreaming in Spanish? Because that's mm-hmm. just kind of like your default way of looking at the world. And then just, yeah. So it's a good. But of course, the Spanglish, right? That's just mm-hmm. such a common thing. You know, we all incorporate it in ways because even here, like, it's such an everyday part of life that we do it just so naturally. And mm-hmm. we're fluent in it. Fluent in Spanglish. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's part of our border culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of a nice memory, but also made me feel kind of sad, you know, mm-hmm. thinking like how much Spanish I have lost.
Yeah, to that made me feel mm-hmm. sad in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely talked about that in past episodes on this show.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the track, right? The intro, first track, right? I do like how you acknowledge how it's like her frame from like a kindergartner
mm-hmm.
point of view, but even her attention to detail, like the clothes, what she's wearing, like all that stuff, and the way she relates the excitement
mm-hmm.
of, you know, an enthusiastic girl that age, just, and then of course this is kind of the first chapter where you also like mm-hmm. a disappointment in life. Yeah. There's disappointment in life. We get to experience that. But I don't know. I guess, did you want to continue to looking at specific passages?
Yeah, I mean, the last one is pretty powerful. Because, oh, I mean, the title is Say You'll Be There. And, I mean, I think that's a great choice for this one just because of, I mean, this is the first time that she's really let down by her father. And he's not there for her, like, and the idea of promises and like him not being there, like, even though he promised, I think that that's really, I don't know, it's it's tough, yeah. I think for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so the setup of that, of course, is her excitement for show and tell. And
mm-hmm.
you guys remember show and tell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved show and tell.
Like, yeah, I like how she kind of even captures that, you know, as a kid, like, we wanted to win. Like, you always want to have, like, the coolest the thing to show off, show like, wow, everyone. And, you know, that's such a huge setup of like, you know, her dad, like,
mm-hmm.
everyone's going to go crazy, you know. And
yeah.
It's
awesome.
I really like that throughout the chapter. So it kind of leads to what Vanessa was saying at the end of the chapter, that disappointment. It makes it that much more prominent, I guess, mm-hmm. because she's talking about how at the bottom of page 21, that last paragraph, I have a hard time remembering everything I thought, everything that was said, which sides of which stories were real. But I know mommy picked me up from school most days, and some days when my papi was in town, he'd be the one to drive me. And then she talks about, like, being in the car and then just, like, how it was just a different experience mm-hmm. getting picked up by him and going mm-hmm. and getting McDonald's. And it was its own, like, nice memory. And so this is nostalgic, Emily.
Precious.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she's remembering that. And so she's like, I want to show off my dad. And, you know, she asked him and he's like, of course, mija, you know. So it's just like building up, building up, building up mm-hmm. until that day. And then in the middle of this chapter, she gives a great Santa Claus interject. I don't know how else to call it.
Yeah, I would agree with you. A little, little interjection.
Yeah.
She found out Santa Claus wasn't real.
Yeah. And it's just kind of right in the middle of this chapter, you know, so there's like this other man that she was disappointed by.
Yeah, it automatically kind of sets up let down. It was a very interesting choice.
Yeah, it was a really interesting choice. And then, you know, the day comes and it's just like looking at the clock and the seconds and the minutes and everything. And she's like, he's coming. And we know as readers, he's not coming. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes that much more heartbreaking, I guess, you know, watching this all unfold. I don't know. I liked, even though it's a really sad story, I liked the pacing of it, you know, because it builds up that tension.
Yeah.
And even though we already know how it's going to end or anticipate how it's going to end, we still feel really let down with her.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I like how you mentioned the pacing because we did mention it too. But like, you know, I remember being that age and like the school day just felt like so long, right? That waiting in anticipation, like, it's 11. So it's been so long. And then like just throughout the day, like she captured that so well.
Yeah. And even in that last paragraph, she has a sentence there that's repeated twice. Mm-hmm. So she says, promises are supposed to be forever and ever, and dads aren't supposed to lie. And then a few sentences down, she repeats that same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So again, kind of capturing that, you know, child innocence, where she just doesn't understand it. She doesn't see why he wasn't there. And all she knows is that it was a promise and he lied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that case, you know, I think the introduction, like the whole Santa part, I can see now how the contrast, it hits harder. Because for her, like, yeah, she found out, but like, she was also already kind of skeptical then, right? Because they tried to like convince her. And there's a sense of like fabrication and all that too. Like, okay, this is the real world. Mm-hmm. And here, this is also the real world. So it hits harder, right? And it's talking about promises.
Yeah, it's a good point.
So I think it has that impact with that contrast.
I also want to mention in that paragraph that I read on page 21 where she says, I have a hard time remembering everything. That's the first time, and she does it a few times throughout the book or throughout the essays, where she admits that memory is one of those things that's like really tricky to write about. To write about. Especially something like she's a lot older now. Not a lot older, but older now. And she's remembering things from when she was 5, you know. And even though she has a lot of detail, there's still things that she's not going to remember, you know, 100%. So I like that she's also vulnerable and truthful in saying that not everything here is going to be exactly how it was, but this is how I remember it. You know, writing about memory is always really tricky.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that builds a great connection with, I think, the reader by interrogating, you know, acknowledging that your memories are not going to be perfect, constructing. You're right. She does mention other times, too, later on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess we'll wait till we get to them to talk about it, right? But good, you know, good intro. Kindergarten Emily here and her kind of first, you know, his first track.
Who's, it's Say You'll Be There by
the Spice Girls.
Oh, that's what I thought. And I was like, I hope it's the Spice Girls because if not, I'm going to feel so dumb. Okay. Because I haven't looked at her playlist and some of the titles I do know. And the ones that she mentions within the essay, I do know. But some of these track titles, I was like, I need to probably go back and check that out. So track 2, Heartbreak Hotel. What do you all think about this one?
So I mean, I know that in this case, this is where she mentions, right, memory again, like everyone has like their different perception of like what happened that day, but they can all agree on one thing, right? It's pretty deeply emotional, right? This memory.
Yeah. Do you guys want to talk about what what that memory is? The phone call.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the title of the essay first. So this song is by Whitney Houston. And she talks about how her mom would listen to this album a lot. So it kind of is tied to this memory, this album. I think that's really important, like the idea of the whole album being tied to a certain time in your life. But like from the song, her mom is heartbroken. The dad is essentially having an affair and decides to start a new family with this woman. And kind of, this is, I think, she was already kind of disappointed earlier in the first essay, but this one's where she really does truly feel abandoned by him.
Yeah. And at this point, she's still around that age, right?
Mm.
Like six or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And so, I mean, she's a child having to deal with this trauma, like learning about new family, her papi leaving and not understanding why or what she did, because there's always that, what did I do? Mm-hmm. Like, what could I have done to keep him here? Kind of like guilt that children automatically just take on.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he leaving us, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, no kid should ever have to be asking these questions, right? But she just knew what she was experiencing. She didn't know why.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it so much more tragic, you know. And she wasn't even the youngest one. There were, like, younger ones in the house.
Old brother Hector.
Yeah.
It's this one's a really short one, mm-hmm. passage, or essay. I like how it starts so lighthearted. Like, I think that opening paragraph is just filled with humor. I love that, like, the talk to me again, just talking, thinking about that, like, the attitude, you know, little young girl, like, wants, you know, answering the phone with that. And also kind of being appalled, like, about 30 being, that joke of 30 being over the hill. I'm like, no, stop it. but, yeah, I think I had referenced on the next page, what, 32, right? With the second to last paragraph, right, where we talk about, again, memory, right? My sister swears in adulthood she was the one to pick up the child to wonder who was on the line. When we ask our mommy for the truth, this part of the memory has blurred too much for her too, but we all agree what came next. Like, I like the way she added that in there.
Yeah. Because, I mean, ultimately it doesn't matter who answered.
Because it's that, what happened.
It's just what happened. Yeah. What was said over the phone. And this was back in the time of landlines.
Oh, man.
So she starts, she starts it with that, you know, like how when you're a kid and the phone rings, you want to be the one to answer it. I remember this too. There were six of us, so we'd always like fight to get to the phone.
Yeah.
And it's a really cute, you know, memory that she has, like how she would answer the phone with talk to me, you know. She's little. And so it kind of starts with that, and then, you know, when you think about it, no one really, I mean, they're still rushing to the phone, but to get this news is like, that's where the heartbreak comes in. And I really like that the last couple lines on 34, when she says, when the house was dark and quiet, when me and my sister were alone together in our room, I would remember our papi wasn't there, but I would remember mommy and Erica and Hector were. And then later, when a cousin is trying to show her a picture of her half baby sister, right? I think at the end of the chapter, that's when she feels like really conflicted, because she loves babies, and she saw that baby picture and she thought it was such a cute baby and she wanted to keep it. She's like, I pretended I didn't want to look at the baby picture anymore, even though I wanted to snatch it and maybe keep it safe forever or maybe rip it apart.
Yeah.
I really like that line because it just shows the conflict in her, you know. It is a really short chapter, just focusing on that conversation and what that meant for their family. What their family was going to look like after that, which then leads into Amor Prohibido.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's anything else you want to say about Heartbreak Hotel.
No, I don't have anything else.
Okay. So in Amor Prohibido, she is in third grade now. And here, you know, we kind of start seeing a little bit more of like her personality, and she starts talking about boys that she likes that are in her class, but also, you know, singers like Justin Timberlake. And, you know, different brands that she likes to wear. And so she's starting to go through one of the phases. So we'll talk, I'm sure, about the phases that she goes through in her adolescence. But this is where that kind of starts. And I also notice that this chapter is where her weight complex kind of begins. Yeah, and so we should mention, you know, that the book talks a lot about hard topics like eating disorders and suicide and self-harm. And so even though, you know, we're kind of starting off with like she's dealing with childhood trauma, abandonment, it's going to lead into these other hard-hitting topics. Mm-hmm. I think this is where that kind of starts. Yeah. What do you all think?
Yeah, on page 38, I think, is probably the line. I mean, yeah, the paragraph. Well, she goes to, like, an aftercare, like, after school, like, a kind of like a daycare kind of thing.
But on purpose, right? On she purpose. Wants to hang with the cool kids.
Yeah. But, so she writes, at aftercare, there are also snacks, which I eat a bunch of, but not too much when the boys are around. We all eat chips, and I already know it would be weird if I ever dared to eat more than one bag of chips. Even weirder if I ate more than the growing boys. Mm. I think that's kind of where it starts, for sure.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, where did she pick that up? I feel like someone probably, like, mentioned it to her.
Yeah.
Ladies don't eat that much. Right. Or, you know, it's not ladylike, or I feel like.
So it's something you kind of, as a kid, internalize and become more self-conscious of your behavior, where, you know, if we're up to her, yeah, I'm going to have some chips. Yeah, you know. the boys. Yeah, like how she mentions at the beginning, like Justin Timberlake and sometimes JC too. Sometimes though.
Yeah.
Yeah, elementary school crushes.
I know.
Those were always interesting, huh?
I know. I had a crush on Justin Timberlake too.
So embarrassed. Any Connors in the world?
No. I know. I do. I mean, it does seem like she had, like, this, you know, white boy complex. And I wrote that, but I'm like, I don't know if that's actually what was happening, or is it just because it was her environment? Like, there's just...
She does mention it at the end of,
you know,
this
essay, too, like, because that all my only options here in Vanilla, Belmont.
Right. Go ahead.
I was just going to add that she also wants to look like them. She talks about how people at school would call her ugly, and she believed them. It says, I'm not beautiful like Britney Spears. And I wrote next to that, white, because that's what I got from it. Because a lot of, they're bullying her for having darker skin than they do.
Yeah. And she does have that essay later on, too, talking about trying to whiten her skin. Yeah, I mean, so this isn't in here, at least related here, like one of the first instances where she kind of experiences some colorism, right? Some.
This is the first time someone called me too dark. And yeah, so definitely like that self-awareness that, and we've all heard, like, you know, you're not born racist, but you learn it, right? Or you become aware of it. Later on, you have to go through some sort of experience like this. Most of us do. So this was her experience, right? Where they said she was too dark, or they thought she was black. Yeah, and this is third grade.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of like awareness now, like, oh, I am dark. I don't look like them. I mean, she knows, she can see herself, see them, knows that there's a difference. But there isn't that, like, something's wrong with me until someone tells you something's wrong with you. that you start to think, is it wrong or am I?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, they make fun of it and laugh, and it's coming from, like, even, like, the crush.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you don't forget easily. Mm-hmm. That sticks with you.
Yeah, for sure. Connor. I wonder what Connor's doing now.
probably not on a book tour.
Exactly. Probably not killing it like Emily is. That's for sure.
I do like how she also adds there at the end, right? You know, this is the first time someone called me too dark. So loud and so clear. I remember thinking I could have said, I am Mexican, not black. But I also knew in the moment it didn't even matter. The point was, I am too different. My skin is too dark, and I will never be liked by someone who isn't dark like me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those things as kids we carry with us, like these moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are quick, like little vignettes, too, you know, like memories. So it goes like by
one
quickly.
Instance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing that happened, yeah.
Supernova girl. Oh, snap. Here comes the pop culture references.
Oh, I know. I'm trying to. Oh, so she's 10 in Supernova Girl. Yeah, she's talking a little bit more about Spice Girls and Disney Channel original movies. This one's super short.
It's a nice memory, though. I like it because it's just kind of like a slice of, I think also. It just captures that thing, you know, when you're a kid and you start to get more self-dependence and, like, well, not self-dependence, but just, you know, you're more on your own, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just this notion of, like, life is good. You know, you have your cartoons, like you have what you want on. You've got your Wendy's. I'm going to go to my room and just, like, dig in, enjoy, like... It's good to recognize that stuff too, you know, those little moments.
Yeah. I do like that she included that. And it does remind me of, like, TGIF. Do you guys remember that? You probably don't, Vanessa. Mm-hmm. Do you remember TGIF? Like, they had a bunch of different, like, shows on Friday nights. I think it was ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, Sabrina. I can't remember any of the other ones. Me and my sister Mo used to watch those. We look forward to Fridays and have, like, a bunch of snacks.
Mm.
So we kind of did, like, the same thing.
Yeah.
And then later on, like, I would go do other stuff, like, with friends. And then, like, that was over, you know? Like, that little memory. But, yeah, my sister still remembers those, too.
Nice. So, yeah, me and my sister, it was definitely the Disney Channel original movies.
Nice.
Like, the Cheetah Girls, High School Musical.
Oh, that's nice. Those are nice moments.
Yeah. I really like the last two paragraphs on this one, though. I just want to say them out loud real quick.
Yeah.
She says, I take my first bite of burger and think, this is the best Friday night ever. I am happy. I don't know. I just, that as an ending note for this section, I really like that.
Yeah. And especially, like Richie said, like, it's a nice little slice of happiness amongst all this other crap that's going on.
Yeah.
And the realizations and other not so happy feelings. It's like, at least she has Friday nights, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Take a nice bite of the burger. Your alone time.
I should have brought Wendy's today. Yeah. That's what I should have brought.
Yeah. I'm perfect.
Wendy's burgers. We should theme it. So whatever we have to discuss in the next one, whatever she brings up, I'll be like, okay, I'm going to bring that. Yeah, so it's kind of like it goes again into Tragos Amargos, track 5. And this essay is really different from any other essay because it's written for Papi. Papi is the audience. And she's talking about Aguililla, where he's from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was she born there too? I don't remember.
Think so.
I mean, she definitely spent time there in her youth. So at least visiting, right?
In Aguinilla, the sister city to the Madera Roja, where I was born. Oh. There were other little brown girls like me. The kids mostly seemed to treat me as their equals. I passed as normal with ease. There, my Spanish still came to me with fluidity and familiarity, not yet plagued by the fear of sounding too American, too pochita. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what we were talking about earlier. Yeah, so it's kind of serves as like the contrast with like the mother tongue and the homeland versus, you know, Belmont, white Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, seeming normal over there, not being questioned about the skin color, those kinds of things. Yeah, there's kind of a lot going on in this.
Oof. Yeah, there's some lines chapter. That really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do like that even with all the, I don't know, like negativity or like dark themes in this chapter, that it's still, she still describes Aguililla and her homeland like in a very beautiful way. Like there are really beautiful descriptions here about like the horses and all of that. And so I kind of liked that. Were there any lines that you all found stood out from this chapter?
There's quite a few.
Yeah.
What are some of yours?
On 46, just again, like the idea of being abandoned. And a, kind of like talking about how at this point she still believes in her father and believes in God. But kind of the idea that it's not, that she's not going to very much longer. I don't know which line specifically to say. I'll just say
it's like
one.
At the end of the break, no?
Todavía no supe que en el futuro I'd come to doubt, both after spending months without hearing a word from either of you, meaning him and God. And it's kind of interesting that she feels like she can't hear God. Just this idea of her questioning her beliefs and her faith that she's been raised with. I mean, I think the way that I was raised is kind of like, he's always talking to you. I mean, I'm not sure if I agree with that, but just this idea that she's like now starting to question that based off of like her past experiences with just men in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I wrote dark at the end of that break just because how she ends it after that sentence that Vanessa just read. Todavía sin comprender que en el futuro the cows too would come to lose their sparkle. The cows avail for the truth. The cows too, victims of your web of lies.
Mm.
So now she's starting to really like, I don't know if internalize is like the best word, but like really just come to terms with how she's feeling and like expressing that in a way that seems, I don't know if angry or just.
I think just hurt in general. Just this feeling of abandonment from.
Like she knows what it is.
From,
now.
Yeah, like from who she really felt like she could count on. And she's just like finding out that she can't rely on them.
And there's that feeling of like visiting his homeland, all that, what that brings, you know, like. She says it right in the last paragraph of the way she said that, right? Tracing the tracks of our homeland, searching for the innocence we both lost here in the United States, hoping to bandage my wounds instead of inheriting our family's brokenness. Mm-hmm. So she talks about kind of being a Chicana, right? Split in two. And you also now have this addition of being his daughter, right? Because, again, it's addressed to him.
Mm-hmm.
The most complicated puzzle of her life. So kind of visiting is that kind of brings up all of that, you know, confusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was interesting this idea of her talking about this little relationship with the boy there, right? And even just talking about like, I also learned that at my novio's side, I became branded, right? Like, just an interesting social thing, right? Like where you're suddenly protected against the catcalls and the whistles of viejos, right? Because you have a, now there's a boyfriend and it's just kind of this really messed up idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you're claimed, or she says you're branded, right? Like, and that's often what I know a lot of women have to do to like push off unwarranted advances from people is like, oh, I have a boyfriend. Even if that's not true, but that's oftentimes what works.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was like a interesting little point there that she kind of brings up.
I think also like with this relationship, she's, I mean, I don't, she's 10.
And he's 16.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That in itself is kind of questionable, but I mean, also she feels accepted by somebody. And I think that she was going to accept that from anybody who, no matter who it was, as long as she had that feeling.
Yeah, and we're reading it in contrast to the other part where, you know, her crushes, like, instead make fun of her. And
yeah.
You're different.
And then after that paragraph, she does say, when I was 10, I hadn't yet formed the walls of stone you helped me build.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also kind of reminds us that she is 10. And, you know, to Vanessa's point, like, the 16-year-old is giving her that kind of attention or showing her a new way to look at herself that maybe she needed, messed up as that sounds.
Right. That's why you kind of mentioned like the dark again all around of this.
So dark. And then at the end, I just wrote deep cuts. Deep cuts.
We have again another photograph to close out this chapter.
Yeah, that photo of her sitting on her papi's lap. I'm assuming in Aida, maybe not.
Yeah.
But so we are probably gonna end up ending with keep your head up.
Yeah, let's just do that.
Okay.
Let's go into it.
Vanessa, you wanna talk about this since you're a Tupac fan? I wanna get into this.
I don't know where to start. I mean, I really like this song.
It's a great song.
I think I wrote one of the lines from the song, like right under the title, things are going to get easier. And I think this one is just more hopeful in comparison to some of the other ones that we've talked about already. Where to go?
Well, I do want to say that this is the essay that started the whole collection. Mm-hmm. So she did talk about that, how she... Well, it started the collection and it started the mixtape tradition of titling the essays. Mm-hmm. So she did mention that in the reading. She knew when she wrote this that she wanted it to be Tupac. And so I really enjoyed that tidbit.
Yeah.
Here she does talk about race and identity a lot more. How people of color are seen as othered and outcasted. And she gets into like her phases, which we hinted at earlier. So there's quite a bit going on in this essay.
Kind of growing into her personality.
Yes. What she wants to be, how she wants to portray herself. And we can see that just in the photographs too.
Yeah. I love the AOL names, name names.
I know. Do you remember yours?
Yeah. Red Dragon 15, you know, red colors, like, you know, it's just, you laugh because they know, like, kids, like, what sounds cool? Like, I love, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
I don't remember mine, but I'm sure it had, like, an Incubus song somewhere. Yeah, I don't remember. I'll have to think about it. Yeah, she talks about, like, her punk phase and Napster, TRL. Stuff like that I grew up with too.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like a transitional paragraph too, not just in like the phases she's going through trying to figure out like her identity and stuff, but like she's also starting to rebel at this stage.
There's a lot in this. It's the longest one to date too, longest
Yeah. And I really like the how the voice is changing here too. Where she's like calling people out. Mm-hmm. Like on page 51, she says, I had totally convinced my Latina friend Monique to go punk with me because she said yes, but then she chickened out before picture day. She was such a poser. I, on the other hand, begged my mom to pay extra so I could get a red background for picture day. I looked very punk.
Very punk.
I love those little, you know, mm-hmm. like moments where she's coming into her own. She's like, and at that age, I feel like a lot of us are just like, everyone's like, oh, what kind of shoes do you have? Oh, those are awesome. Or like, mm-hmm. you know, wow, your parents bought you, you know, that brand of jeans or whatever. I mean, when we were kids, I don't know if it's the same anymore, but mm-hmm. I remember there was a lot of that, mm-hmm. like kind of showing off what you were wearing and your style.
Street cred.
mm-hmm. Mm. So she name drops a lot of like brands and, you know, that as a kid would like DKNY and BB. I can't remember what other ones.
Baby fat jeans.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Taylor's.
Yeah.
Like I don't know. I just love the line on 52. You guys probably have it highlighted or it. Not long after I began experimenting with being a chola.
Yeah, I just circled it.
Chola. Just the idea, like, I experimented with being a chola.
Well, at the end of that paragraph, being chola was a birthright. It was in my blood.
Yeah.
Mm. I underlined that. I love that.
Absolutely. Mm. Like, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, so she went from punk to preppy to chola, which is, like, hard to do in, like, a year. Like, Dickies jacket. Ooh, I'm wearing my Dickies hoodie today. Yeah. So I guess I'm a chola too. I don't know.
I think we're basically going to make the transition where this podcast is also going to be visual. So in the future, we can point it out.
Yeah. In the future, you'll see if I'm lying or not.
I vouch. She is wearing her Dickies hoodie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's like this chola mentality too that she kind of, hints at, I guess, on page 52, mm-hmm. like how cholas are tough or like the stereotypical, you know, rebellious and not going to be good at school or just going to look like mad dog you and everyone's afraid of us kind of thing.
Wow.
I know. Kids.
Yeah, I mean, I love the description of it, right? Like, I became a pro at shooting people dirty ass looks to make them feel disgusting. I loved rolling my eyes all dramatic right in front of people's faces.
Yeah. Yeah, and then later on that same page, she talks about how just in school she couldn't relate to what she was reading and she didn't like mm-hmm. any of it. She says it all felt fake, nothing like what real people like me dealt with every day. And I think that's such a strong line, you know, that kind of brings in, like, why this book is kind of, you know, getting so much exposure right now. And people are talking about Emily and more writers of color, because there are a lot of people of color reading this who say, that's my story, too. And wouldn't we rather read that than something by Shakespeare that we can't relate to?
Right, which goes mm-hmm. back to that point in the intro, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the second half of this, I think, or the last part of this, is where she goes into the relationship that she had with Cami, I don't know how,
mm-hmm.
Who was the woman that her papi left their family for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of, I guess, recap this section, she talks about how she had a good relationship with her at first. You know, mm-hmm. Cami encouraged her. She, you know, if Emily, young Emily was like, I want to be a photographer, she would buy her, you know, those disposable cameras before cell phones, right? and like picture frames, and she did her like dressed her up because she wanted to be a model. So kind of like a nice relationship that she had, but then of course it became a little more complicated, and Cammie was holding a grudge for like 3 years or something that Emily said when she was 10, which just blew my mind. And then she transitions into going to therapy. Emily does. Cutting and just ways to deal. So she's kind of in this chapter trying to find herself, but also trying to learn how to deal with things that are going on in your life. And of course, going back to the chapter title, music being one of those things that really helped her through these experiences.
I think also this one talks a lot about betrayal. She doesn't feel like she can trust anyone at this point. And she kind of starts to isolate herself a lot more. Which kind of eventually leads to her cutting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think also on 57, towards the middle of the page, they're kind of suggesting that she start taking medication. And I think this end of the paragraph is really important. She says, "I was scared. I didn't want to get addicted to anything. I didn't want to depend on anyone or anything. I wanted to be strong on my own." I don't know. I think that that's really important. But at the same time, she does kind of start developing these probably not so healthy coping mechanisms from the things she's experienced, despite not wanting to start taking medication.
Right. And then with therapy, it's like she was going and all of that, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's like, oh, it's just these old white people who are telling me who probably have never gone through this or whatever. So she doesn't really connect or make the most of the help that she was getting.
Doesn't have that impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, I mean, so going into those spaces, that type of darkness, mental darkness, she goes into music and how that saved her life pretty much, right? And then she goes on a good couple pages on Tupac specifically, right? Mm-hmm. Because now you have a contrast to whereas in school she couldn't really relate as much. She, you know, now you have Tupac, right? Talking about, you know, to love herself, right? And he, you know, he was suicidal. He was going through this, you know, and of course, like you said, she also learned through that because through that connection, right, about things like police brutality and poverty, maybe more of a connection. So I don't know. Do you have any passages in that little section there?
Yeah, I mean, right after like kind of where you were talking about, this idea of acceptance kind of comes back in. And she writes, "He taught me my skin is beautiful. He was the first person to tell me how lucky I am to be brown. He taught me I was beautiful."
Yeah. And she also ends that page with the same thing. "He saved my life. He taught me I am beautiful."
Mm-hmm.
So she reiterates that point.
Yeah.
That goes back to stupid Connor, right? And saying that, first of all, misidentifying her, like saying that, you know, she's black or whatever. And she's like, well, actually, I'm not. But, and then her questioning if she was beautiful or if those two things were mutually exclusive, right? Mm-hmm. Like being brown and beautiful, which she, you know, found to be true with Tupac's music.
Mm-hmm.
Which is beautiful to me. I also just want to say that, like, you know, a lot of people who don't listen to rap or hip hop or in specific genres might misunderstand the music because of what they think it is, or what a lot of it is, or what the rapper is or looks like. And so she brings awareness, or, you know, some attention to that in this chapter too, that he was misunderstood. but that they, if people really just listened to him, they would realize how smart he actually was and how a lot of the things he was singing or rapping about was truth. And yeah, so I kind of wanted just to emphasize that in case there's anyone out there who might not want to listen to a band or an artist because of what they look like or whatever.
Yeah, no, thanks for mentioning that. That's true. Plenty of people quickly dismiss hip hop for some of those reasons that are purely misinformed or based on, you know, misconceptions. The whole thing. That whole essay there, that is like, there's a lot more because I know there's a lot more that happens too. Mm-hmm. But I know just for time, we'll continue right next episode.
Yeah.
Finish the rest of the book. That's not another there's no chapter titles there, but you can hear it in your head.
I know.
Next episode.
I should put that on my playlist.
Right.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Literally Literary, brought to you by Border Senses and Power at the Pass. This episode, we continued our discussion on Funeral for Flaca by Emily Prado. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll continue this discussion. If you haven't read it, we hope we inspire you to pick up a copy. Follow us on Instagram at literallyliterary.ep and on Twitter at literallylitep.